Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Code Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, but it is with greater relevance that I note the presence of Cole Chaney.
Yes.
Whom you all have heard of before. And new team members, Nathan Miller, Aline Sanduk, right?
Hello.
And Ethan Craig.
How we doing?
Welcome to the show, guys.
It's great to be here.
M1s. I need to start with you. So Nathan, Aline, and Ethan, you guys are first-year medical students, a proud addition to the College of Medicine. And I guess at this point, after your first week of classes is all but done, it's only appropriate to ask the question, will you continue your pursuit of an MD?
I really enjoyed the first week of classes.
It's yeah.
been a nice balance of subjects.
Are you ready to commit to a favorite lecturer or professor?
No comment.
All right, fair enough. Ethan?
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. It's been a good first week. In reference to a favorite, keeping my ears open, don't want to commit too early.
All right. No, I admire that. Aline?
It's everything I thought it would be and more.
Wow.
Now, all of you...
Quite the endorsement.
Now, were all of you intro to medical education at Iowa students?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you guys spent some time here over the summer, and now you're into it. Did IME prepare you?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
It did a great job, especially like an anatomy lab. Super, super chill.
Mm-hmm.
Very
all right.
comfortable with that.
I have an IME story. I'm an
M2. Oh, nice.
So I did IME.
Nice.
I failed almost every exam. Almost everyone, and I was very nervous. And then the school year turned out to be not too bad at all. But I had like a huge, like more anxiety.
Were you freaked out? You must have been freaked out.
Yeah, I was just like, I can't hack it. Like, I'm really scared, but I'll do a couple weeks to make my parents happy in med school. and then like quit. And it actually like, I don't know. So you guys all seem very smart. I'm sure you did well on the test. But if you did well there, you'll do twice as well.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
To me.
And like, I put my whole heart in this one test, like in like my soul into this test. And I got like a 69. Ooh. Like, and that's still failing. So I was like, well, whatever.
I wonder if you were the canary in the coal mine for IME. Like, they were like, oh my God.
I seriously had to talk with them. I was like, so are you guys going to kick me out before I start? Or like, how does this work? And they're like, no, it's common. Don't worry about it. Just make sure to work really hard.
I'm sure you weren't the only one. And
it's very cathartic.
What did you do before you came to medical school?
Working.
Whatever, working.
So I was an investment banker for a year, and then I was a teacher for a year.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Seriously.
I could not be a medical student. I'm clearly not smart enough, or at least my brain would explode. And I don't have the school was just a disaster. College was just a disaster for me.
We talked about this.
Yes.
People who maybe weren't ready for the right school at the right time.
Absolutely. So I admire you for not like running in fear.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate
it. And you guys as well, because I'm sure you heard all sorts of stuff about, oh, medical school is the hardest thing you'll ever do and blah, 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 blah.
We haven't even taken an exam yet, so it's hard to gauge.
Oh my God, we're totally freaking them out.
See, that's the thing. It was great, but...
Until you sat down to do this podcast.
In IME, they really held our hands. There's no other way to say it. We got a lot of help. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it should be...
Well,
it helps you. It's good. It's a little head start, I think, on the education.
But also, I don't know. I think unlike my college experience, where it's kind of like, I went to a great, bloody great university, huge university, 60,000 or 30,000 students.
Say?
Yeah, University of Massachusetts.
There we go.
UMass.
There's nobody holds your hand. You're just like, and, sink or swim. Whereas here... I think you'll get the help you need if you need it. You might have to make sure to ask for it. But in general,
they do a great job.
They sort of keep an eye on you a little bit, which I think is kind of cool. And I don't think it's common.
No, I don't think so.
Very distinct.
Favorite subject so far?
I've been really enjoying Anatomy Lab. Yeah. Again, the exposure through IME was great. And so now it's kind of like a review, and I already know most of the terms and things. So it's just going through the donors and identifying them and the different ones. It's really cool.
Identifying that. The donors?
Not identifying the donors. Hopefully some structures at least.
All right. Yeah. Structures. Yeah. I thought that sounded weird. Aline, same?
Actually, I really enjoy CAPS.
CAPS?
Yeah. It makes me feel very doctory to talk about interview patient.
This is clinical and professional skills, so yeah. We're talking about the things you need to know to...
Step one, introduce yourself. Step two, put hand on shoulder. Step three, ask for their name.
You know, like, this stuff sounds...
It's mechanical.
This stuff sounds, you know, maybe at first glance, like, you introduce yourself. But at the same time, it's helpful to know what is expected of you, like, as much as possible, what your patients want, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And Iowa's unique in that they plug you in this clinical mindset early. A lot of schools do a lot of basic sciences, and then maybe second semester of second year you'd get this. But you guys get plugged in right off the bat, which is, it's pretty cool.
What's the worst thing so far?
Oof, I'm just going to say the four-hour blocks that we've had this week. Yeah. We've had 4 hours today, 4 hours Wednesday of chemistry and cellular biology. So it's just a lot of dense information for 4 hours.
We went from like Monday and Tuesday, we had like mass and caps both mornings, and then Wednesday all of a sudden we were hit with 4 hours of foundations and then a quiz over it right away on Thursday.
Chemistry. I never took chemistry.
It's probably a good thing for your life.
No.
The day is young, Dave.
No. I acknowledge the chemicals are my friends. That's all I'm doing with chemistry.
It's okay to let chemistry be the kind of thing where you're like, oh, good, someone else knows how to do this, so I don't.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Outsource.
I'm outsourcing my knowledge of everything. So, and Aline, same thing, long classes.
Yeah. A lot of material. I mean, it's stuff we've seen before, but it's just like the stuff in college that the professor would say like, oh, you don't have to worry about that. Like now we have to worry about all that stuff. We have to memorize a lot. So.
Have you discovered any techniques that you, I mean, it's only been a week, so I doubt it, but you had IME. So, I mean, did you discover any studying techniques or did you come prepared in some way? Did you have a plan?
I relied on what I did in undergrad, but I don't think that worked. But your story really inspired me. Inspires hope for my life.
Good.
Because I didn't do very well on the test.
Even a loser can become a doctor.
Yeah, well, what Amen. Are you implying? I didn't come here to be insulted.
Thanks, Dave.
But I'll stay because...
Yes, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Things
You're
come
welcome.
Out of my mouth. It's unconsidered. I don't...
Yeah, no, it was really good. At least we knew what to expect coming into the first semester. That was really huge.
We also developed some great group studying dynamics, I guess, during IME, where we'd hang out after class, and especially for anatomy, that was great. But also a little bit with some of the foundation stuff, like biochemistry. That was good.
So... Profile your class. I want to know, is there, if you had to assign personality traits to your class as a whole, where what would we go with?
There's a lot of captains of the football teams, if that makes
tall.
Sense.
It's a tall class.
There are a lot of very tall people.
I'm telling you, they're getting taller every year. I'm serious. Or I'm getting shorter, but they are, I think they're getting taller. Yeah. Captains of the football team types.
So jockey.
Like conventionally attractive people, the ski slope nose and the bright colored eyes and the, you know, 6 feet.
That's a good description. That's really specific.
I wasn't expecting that.
It's accurate. Well, it's not my type, but that's why I say conventionally good looking people.
All right, fair enough.
And the girls too, actually. There's a lot of very like good looking people in the class.
Thank you, Aline. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. It was a veiled compliment for you.
Wait till you get sick of everybody and they all look really ugly. Like mid-year.
Yeah, we'll have to have you come back and report on that.
I will.
Have things change. What about personality wise? Because I find that every class, we as a staff here, find that every class has a distinct, each class has a distinct personality.
Well,
like M2 class, Cole.
Yes.
What would you at this point go with for your class?
Oh my gosh. I can't even tell you. I think they're pretty. They work really hard. They're smart people. I don't know. This is really
are
broad.
They, are they joiners?
Do joiners.
They, do they do?
Are they involved? Oh,
are they involved? I guess maybe.
Yeah, I actually heard that from class to class. Certain ones are really involved.
Others are like dead.
M3 class or no? It'll be the M4 class this year. Had a very high board score, and then I heard all the other classes be like, "Yeah, but they didn't do anything. Yeah, like they weren't involved." That was sort of the argument presented.
Right. Well, you know,
I'm not commenting on it.
No, I mean, you know, that's the rumor.
What's your M2?
I know quite a few of the M2s, and I like quite a few of them. And that's, I mean, but that's not any different from any other class. So I'm not really sure. What I do know, what I think I know about the M1s this year, and we'll see if this is borne out. I think they are an outgoing group.
Okay.
I would agree with
would
that.
Would you go with that? I feel I have this vibe already of a group that... Because I see you guys hanging out in the atrium over lunch sometimes, and there's lots of you, which... Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they're all, you know, M1s, maybe a couple M2s, but...
Yeah, I think there's potential to be outgoing, but it's still a little early to tell, and people still have their guards up. They don't know if they make friends. They haven't yet gotten to that point where you're supposed to realize that you're all in this together, and it's okay to be vulnerable, and it's okay to put yourself out there.
Right.
We went through that over the summer, and the greatest part about doing IME is that we came into the class with 14 very good friends, 14 friendly faces that we could reach out to for help. I'm really glad I have that, but none of those folks have that yet. They're in the process.
Yeah. Yep.
That was.
And it's. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go on. As far as a personality, it's been hard because it's such a big class. But and I think it's kind of an IME bias. There seems to be just a lot of nervous students.
Okay.
A lot of people that are feeling overwhelmed already. We're feeling overwhelmed on Wednesday before we had really started anything. So I think. Yes, it's exactly that. They're not comfortable yet. They're not really sure what this is going to look like.
So maybe I'm being premature in my judgment.
I think you're right.
Okay. Oh, you think I'm right, but...
I think you're right, but like there's potential for that, but it's still too early to talk.
All right. We'll see if my suspicions are borne out. I would like it because it would mean that, you know, I don't have to worry about getting podcasters on the show. I can.
This is a testament right here to being out.
Well, this is
involved.
What I'm saying. This didn't happen last year.
3 M1s here right on the first day.
Thank you, Cole. We appreciate you.
Yeah, and I think the other problem is that, you know, once people do realize, like, oh, this is really hard, they just put their heads down and you don't see them again for the next, you know, year, 8 months or whatever.
Your eyes get all Yikes. Crazy.
Yes, with the swirls.
Swirls in your eyes.
Well, good. I'm glad you guys could make it. I'm glad that things are sort of starting to happen, and we'll have to pay attention, see what happens in the future. We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Hello, welcome to the Short Code Podcast.
I already did that.
I'd take over for you. I have something to talk about before we do. I usually have like 3 to 4 bad news stories that I read, and so I thought I'd delay the pain. So I actually spent last week at
our listeners appreciate
that. Yeah, I'm sure. So I went to I got to do a 1 week training program at the Betty Ford Clinic out in Palm Springs. I just wanted to talk about it a little
bit.
It was a cool experience. So 14 med students from all over the place, although there was one from DMU, which was really interesting. But schools across the country bring us together. Half the day you're essentially a patient, being treated like these patients. So you're in the AA meetings, the council, the therapy, you're in the inpatient unit. You know, when someone comes in with a bad addiction problem, they might just need medical stabilization before we even start to work out the demons. Then the other half of the day is spent actually being sort of the more physician, working with the patient to tease out what's causing some of these addiction problems. And it was a really cool thing, and it's a huge huge plug of med students. I think anyone can apply for it from any med school, DO or MD, and I'd really encourage it because I had a wonderful experience.
So tell us more about your experience on the patient side, as being sort of on the patient side of it.
So as the patient, the joke was that it felt like it was Shutter Island. I don't know if you've seen that movie. You know, so we don't know if Leo DiCaprio is the police officer investigating the psych ward or if he's within the psych ward. So you come in like, I'm a med student, I'm going to learn all this like clinical knowledge, and all of a sudden you're sitting there going like, You're telling a counselor maybe some deep, dark things about yourself. You know, I mean...
And so, do you open up like that?
I mean, absolutely. You kind of have to, because that's part of the environment. So I don't know if you guys have ever been to an AA meeting, but the whole deal is openness is a big tenet, because addiction sort of lives in isolation and it lives in secrecy. And so if you hold all these things here... you might be driven to use again. And so total openness, and it's sort of other people being very open, explaining these stories of just hitting rock bottom. And then you kind of feel like, well, I can't hold out. So you have to tell about something from yourself, maybe some place let your family down, where your family let you down, siblings, friends, etc. And it was a great experience, and I'd encourage everyone to do it, because med students can be really closed off, like incredibly closed off, because we're trained to be very non-biased and objective in our approach to patients.
And also pretty conservative, too, I mean, in terms of, like, what you share with people and, you know, how you...
Someone has diverticulitis, you're not supposed to go, well, you know, I actually had that, too. You're not supposed to do that.
Right.
You console them in a more neutral way.
You're supposed to adopt a clinical persona.
Yeah, and that's probably good for most things, but for this sort of psychiatric delving deep into the person's psyche, it actually really helps to connect with them. So look it up, Betty Ford Clinic. It's a summer institute, and they pay for everything. They fly out, they feed you. It's all celebs and athletes and really interesting people out there. People you can't say, but it's really interesting.
I will resist.
Did you sign a non-disclosure agreement?
I absolutely, yeah, I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Wow.
What happens there stays there.
Sure.
So there's a selection process, obviously. I mean, if only 40 people across get to do it.
But there's about 10 different weeks, so it was 140 total. Okay. I think they prefer people with an interest in addiction psychiatry. So I grew up Loveline, Dr. Drew. Like, that was my thing. I would listen to it nonstop, Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew, and these teenagers would call in, so I loved it. And so that was sort of my sort of inspiration, although that's pretty weak in terms of application.
I was
going
to say, is the reality borne out? Is the reality of the Betty Ford Clinic matching up with Dr. Drew and Adam Carolla?
Dr. Drew wasn't invited to Betty. I was like, so does Dr. Drew ever hang out here? I know he's out in California. I thought maybe I could stalk him or something. And they said he had some funny business with pharmaceuticals, that he had gotten some money and the Betty Ford Clinic was not comfortable with the way he had been doing this. So he was not welcome at that time, although I'm sure things change.
I see.
I don't know if he's a friend of it, though.
And as a... In the physician side of it, when you were doing that, what was that? What, tell us more about that.
It's intense, and so a lot of it's day-to-day maintenance of sobriety. So these people, you know, so when you first get them, they might be getting the shakes and the jitters. They might be having neurological problems, cardio, liver. But after you treat that, that only takes a couple weeks, maybe to a month max, and that's the detox. After that, then it's sort of daily, rigorous, you know, checking in. Have you been dishonest today? Have you felt any resentment today? And so it's very much, you know, in terms of a medical student, what you learn, it's probably, you know, there's zero biochemistry, there's zero anatomy. It's much more of what you would maybe learn later. And psychiatrists are a whole different beast, too, so I realize that it's very different.
Here's what I've read about addiction recently. There is the article I read sort of evinced some doubt about the sort of 12-step program method, especially as now there are better drugs than Anabuse to sort of halt the physical addiction portion of it. Was there any talk about that during the?
So their argument is that it's not the best way, but it's the best we got, you know,
sure,
at this point. But there's definitely drugs. And some of the guys, though, they would talk about there's these injections you can get into your thigh to make you decrease cravings for alcohol, opiates. Some of these people actually found, though, they could drink through that.
Yeah.
And then they'd black out. And so it's like...
So you, like, just drink and drink and drink and then, like...
And nothing happens. And all of a sudden, hits. Yeah. So it's actually kind of dangerous.
All right. Fair enough.
I've lived a very sheltered... I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. Well, they found out. All right. But that's enough of that. I just wanted
to... So cool. Yeah.
And I have some news stories, too. Do you want to do them?
No, please do.
Okay. So in that light, U.S. is to tighten restrictions on common opioid painkillers. So physicians, this is sort of an addiction tie-in to what we were talking about. But hydrocodone, Vicodin, other addictive drugs, the deal was if it was a pure opiate, it was a class 2 drug. But the problem is a lot of these pills also have acetaminophen infused, and this made it a less tightly regulated drug. In other words, patient or doctors could give out 30-day supply, 60-day, 90-day supply in some crazy situations. And also they could call the prescription into the pharmacy. Now it's got to be 1 month supply max and a written prescription, and there's sort of a follow-on checkup process. So what do you guys think of this?
Anything?
I don't know a lot about the DEA process of classifying controlled substances, so it's hard to say whether it's good or bad. But
sure.
I assume there's must be a lot of overdose issues then associated with these acetaminophen mixed drugs. Mm-hmm. Is that the case? Or
yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, liver issues that happen, yeah. And also addiction issues.
So I was surprised recently to get I had some shoulder pain. Why is it every week that I am talking about my medical history?
I know. We go to your bypass too.
It's the only thing I've got. I only have one medical history. Shoulder pain. And was prescribed a 90-day supply of hydrocodone. That sort of...
Is that kind of crazy?
Yeah, that seems like a lot.
Like it was like, you know, three refills. And I'm like... And it, you know, I was like, what?
And was there a discussion?
I didn't really understand it during the appointment. He said, well, I'll give you a prescription. And I sort of looked at it and left. But then I actually got it, and I'm like, I wonder what this stuff is. And, you know, so I looked it up, and I'm like, oh, I am not taking this.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know, I just didn't, you know, I took it for, like, the first dose, and then I was like, I'm going to go with Tylenol.
It's a smart thing to do.
I just didn't feel like it was necessary, or I just didn't feel comfortable with it.
So. Yeah.
Well, moving on. You know what? New policy. No Dave's... I'm not going to be able to do it. No Dave's medical history. You know, I was playing... I played the last episode of the podcast for my parents who came to visit recently. And I realized during it that I also casually brought in my father's medical history as well.
It's like you cannot...
He didn't seem to care.
On a medically themed podcast, I think sometimes you got to... dig deep.
I don't know.
It's okay.
I am always extremely fascinated by biomedical engineering. I'm not sure why exactly. I just think it's cool. So I was intrigued to, first of all, have two biomedical engineers, former biomedical engineers, I guess.
By training.
On the show by training, Ethan and Nathan, whose names also sound very similar. And
we look alike, too.
Yes.
Twins.
My God, it's weird. It's like there's a mirror between
The joke only works for us. For
no, five. No, it gets
maybe like a few people in the M1 class who
there's a
who
slight
know who we are.
There is a slight Asian-y flavor to one. Not really sure which one it is, and the other one is a little bit white.
You can guess.
I'm not sure.
I am a lot of it white. If you knew me. Now that everyone is thoroughly confused, yes. Biomedical engineering.
Biomedical engineering. There is a big problem in the world of giving of having babies. It's postpartum hemorrhage, and you know, here in the West, in the Western world, modern medicine is ways of intervening. But in developing countries, access to those sort of advanced techniques are pretty limited. 99% of deaths from postpartum hemorrhage occur in low resource settings where the majority of women give birth at home, and this is pretty largely due to lack of available resources and training for midwives who do these home deliveries. So an aspiring DO and biomedical engineer, Mikhail Kamal, and biomedical engineer John Esau, I think is how you pronounce it, have invented a device that, instead of using expensive doodads and medical balloons and things like that, uses just a condom inflated with air or saline in the uterus such that it puts pressure on the hemorrhaging tissues and stops the bleed. And the other trick it uses is that it has a visible and audible warning component that prevents over or under inflation, which would be, which is kind of a big problem.
Okay.
Their company, they formed a company, Jaban Health Technologies Incorporated, and they're working to, they've also received, the 2014 Saving Lives at Birth, a Grand Challenge for Development seed grant sponsored by USAID, the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Grand Challenges Canada, and UK Aid. I think that's pretty cool. It also suggests an approach to improving lives through biomedical engineering in whichever field you're passionate about. Find something that works in high-resource medicine and then look for a way to do the same thing in places where low-resource medicine is the norm. What do you guys think about that idea?
Simplicity is really cool, right?
Absolutely.
As an engineer, you can appreciate too many moving parts always creates problems.
That's right. Huge, especially when you're in areas with less resources. Maintaining equipment and things can be very difficult unless you make it very, very simple and mm-hmm. have cheap components.
I mean, this thing is made of it's made of HDPE, which is what milk bottles are made of. So I talked about the audible and visual warning, and I think probably when I first heard that, I was thinking, oh, there's an LED and there's a microchip and there's a thing and this and that. No, it's just a tube out of which the saline will squirt when it gets too full, or it makes a gurgling noise or something. Yeah. You know, like totally dead. You know, simple.
I think that's something that we kind of forget about, even with engineering training here. You instantly go to computer screens and monitors and something's going to bleak and you're going to get beeped if something's wrong. And we kind of lose sight of the mechanical aspects of all of these things that have worked so well. So I think that's also what's exciting about something that takes no electricity, no power, and just works.
Yeah.
Based off design.
Right.
This is so stupid, but in your sink, you know, there's that hole right next to, like, in the sink, there's always that hole.
Right.
You sit there and, like, it's so stupid, but, like, the sink can never overflow because of it. Like, I love that simplicity.
It's so genius.
It's beautiful, right? And it's like the easiest thing in the world.
It has saved my rear end a few times.
Does this tie into a medical story?
No.
Okay.
I have no medical story.
All right, I got a story here.
Go.
Low nicotine cigarettes may not lead to more smoking. So this is interesting. What the researchers did is they toned down the amount of nicotine per cigarette, and so these people would still smoke. And it turned out, you know, the thought is always you're trying to get your nicotine fix, hit that certain level, you know, concentration of nicotine in your bloodstream. Turns out it was more of the behavior of smoking. And so these people, you know, they would actually get fewer side effects because they were getting less smoke, less nicotine. And so the thought is eventually one day we could almost get a nicotine-less cigarette.
Why wouldn't they smoke more in order to get more nicotine?
So this was the postulate, and there's no way to prove this, but the thought is that it's more the behavior and the rewards inherent to the person. In other words, your body will release a little dopamine, you know, when you smoke, as opposed to what you get from the nicotine. It's more the going outside to relax and sit there and have sort of an oral fixation while you do it.
Yeah. No, as a... Oh, geez, here we go again.
All right, let's go.
All right. That didn't last very long.
As a former smoker, I can completely agree with that.
Okay. So you weren't chasing the nicotine per se. It was more the...
No, in fact, I suppose there was a, you know, a little bit addicted to nicotine, but I was always able to give it up for like mime.
Okay.
Until the moment where I was like, you know, I'm going to go to have a drink with my friends at the bar. And then it was, you know, back in that environment, you know, instantly you're like, oh, I'd really like to have a cigarette. So
how'd you maintain abstinence from smoking?
I don't know. I just did.
Like one day you just white knuckled it?
You know what? Well, I mean, like I said, periodically I could quit without really worrying about it, or I just would stop. And then actually I got my first life insurance policy, and they were like, okay, we're going to take a clip of your hair and, you know, we're going to look at it and make sure you're not smoking. I'm like, well, I guess I'm an adult now.
It'd be interesting to see a study that compared the effects of weaning someone off or having cigarettes that slowly decrease nicotine concentration compared to like the gum type stuff that
or
the patches that slowly wean you off the nicotine, and see if there's a, you know, better, if works out better if you use the actual cigarettes rather than the patches. Or
well, that's an interesting point, because the gum would almost refute what the study says, because the gum is still delivering nicotine. So I think there's definitely some holes there, but yeah, that would be really cool to do a side-by-side.
Yeah.
I keep reading stories in the news lately about patients who end up, who are sort of not happy with their doctors. Patients who, you know, were like, I'm sick, and they're like, no, you're not. Or... You know, or they describe their symptoms and the doctor thinks it's one thing, but the patient thinks it's another thing. It turns out the patient is right. And then they go off and write these articles for the New York Times or whatever. So here's one. This is actually, there's a couple of dimensions to the story. Kim Goodsell. I think I got this on Philly.com. As usual, I'll put the links up to the stories that we talk about. Kim Goodsell is an extreme athlete who, years ago, diagnosed with genetic disorder called arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. It's a genetic disorder. Then, years later, she was diagnosed with Charcot-Marie-Tooth. Am I pronouncing that right?
Charcot-Tooth.
Another degenerative genetic disorder that kills off peripheral neurons. And her doctor didn't make any, you know, the doctor who diagnosed the ARVC didn't think there was a connection between the two genetic disorders. But she was like, well, how, I mean, I have two genetic disorders, one of which is extremely rare.
Yeah.
How reasonable is that? So she started with PubMed. She's not a scientist.
Good for her.
She did do a little science in her, like, 30 years ago or whatever, but not a scientist. Looked into it. Started with PubMed, but found that her scientific education just wasn't up to it. But she kept at it. For instance, you know, a lot of Google searching, a lot of finding random articles on CMT or and ARVC and their genetic bases. Ultimately became an expert in these two genetic diseases, presented them to a geneticist, and the geneticist is like, holy crap, you're right.
What's that movie where the woman becomes a lawyer and then, like, saves her? It's like a famous...
Legally Blonde?
Yeah.
Oh.
What's the Hilary Swank one?
I don't remember, but Sam Rockwell's in it. He plays the brother.
Anyway, keep going. But this is like self-education. I like this.
Yeah. So she found a link. She found a gene called LMNA, which has a really long, it's obviously a long name that I forgot to write down. LMNA is linked to another heart problem that doctors sometimes confuse with ARVC.
Mm.
And LMNA is responsible for more diseases than any other known gene. She figured that the LMNA phenotypes matched up with her, you know, her phenotypes. Is that the right word? Phenotypes?
Yep.
Matched up with both CMT and ARVC.
Charcot-tooth.
I love that. So that was her smoking gun there. She really had to convince her, this geneticist and her doctors to take this seriously, because at first they're like, ugh. I don't know. The article makes it sound like they were like,
elitist.
Foolish patient. You know nothing.
They're French now.
Oh, yes. You know nothing.
Charcot-tooth. Aaron Brockovich. That's the movie. This is very Aaron Brockovich.
Oh, I was going to, you know, honestly, I was going to say Aaron Brockovich, but I thought, I've not seen it, so I'm probably.
Oh, you got to get on that.
So she
is now mad at her physicians.
She's not mad, I guess. But I just keep seeing these stories about, like, patients having to take their diagnoses into their own hands, or patients being misdiagnosed. It's a popular media meme.
Okay.
I think lately, right? I mean, have you seen other articles like this? I've got two of them today, so.
But what we want is the patient educated, and if they have a good feeling about what's wrong with them, that's more than just about any doctor could do, because the patient lives their life on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
So, I mean, unfortunately, I wish this wasn't a bad thing, but...
Right. Well, we want the patients to take it into their own hands, but that relationship, it shouldn't be like that. I think it should be more encouraging. Yeah.
I mean, it's the moral here, I guess, is to, you know, listen to your patients. I mean, yeah, a lot of times Dr. Google is going to steer them wrong. I mean, every time I look up a headache, I get like, you know, it's like
fibromyalgia.
Clear I have cancer.
Cancer.
You know?
It's
always cancer.
How many of these cases are there for every case that the doctor did?
Well, that's a good point.
Exactly. I mean, at least listen and think about it rather than adopting an automatic and worse, visible skepticism.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
You know, in rare cases, they might be right. And unless you at least consider the possibility, you might just end up the subject of a newspaper article about a doctor who got it wrong.
Your WebMD, are there grades, like doctor grades online? So you'd fail that portion of the test.
Should I be looking at those for my healthcare?
Yes, and they're always so skewed because every doctor I've ever seen only has like two.
Okay.
And it's either like the two patients that really loved them or the two patients that really hated them.
You're only going to post on there if you had an extreme experience.
That's
one way
true.
Or the other.
And you know what we know now is that, you know, patients who are satisfied are not necessarily patients who are healthy.
If your doctor says,
hey, you're too fat, well, they wouldn't say that, but they would say, you're overweight, you need to lose weight in order to be healthy. Well, the automatic response is going to be, what a terrible doctor.
I need pain pills. No. Yes. Then you give them a bad review. Although, I remember, there was the teacher ranking back in college.
And
one of the categories, though, was hotness.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Maybe you could do that for sure.
Yeah. They had, like, the little chili peppers. Yeah.
We could do that for doctors, though. You know, if you want a hot dog.
That makes me remember the OB that came to town when I was... when I was a young man and hearing my my mother's friends talk about the hot OB.
Oh, he's a guy OB.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's fun.
That'd make me really uncomfortable.
I probably was. I don't
I'd block that out. Here, I got a quick one here.
Yeah.
Consumer Reports states pregnant women should not eat tuna, which I think we already knew that fish and mercury poisoning. And feta cheese, apparently. That was the other one I never...
Yeah, it's a soft cheese thing. You know, they get listeria or something, I think.
You know better than I.
Wow. Well.
Dave, you pull out these random diseases, and I'm like, I'm in my second year. I have never heard of that. You said one the other day.
Is this from a personal health story that you...
Well, you know, I'm a father of two, so I've heard all of these.
I think it was like C. difficile you said once. I was like,
oh, yeah, C. diff.
I got to Google that. Like, what is that? So added to the fish. Right now we have fish to avoid.
I think that's what we're all about here. We're all about learning on the podcast, you know?
Collaboration.
Right.
This is a team-based exercise. Grammar.
If we teach one person something, our job is done. Anyway, so, go ahead.
Here you go. King mackerel, tilefish, marlin, orange roughy, grouper, halibut, bluefish, Chilean sea bass, my favorite. Black cod, Spanish mackerel, and fresh tuna are now on the list for high mercury, and it's getting worse every year.
Huh.
No matter what you think about environmental warming or pollution, there's definitely increased mercury levels. So
stay away from the fish.
Maybe even if you're not pregnant, is the thought of maybe not too much fish, sushi.
Huh.
I don't like fish. Fish is gross.
Okay.
Problem solved.
I'm sorry. There's no chance I'm getting any.
What about fish mercury. Disgusts you?
The taste.
Generally, it's the fishiness.
Yeah. I don't like going by the Hy-Vee fish counter. It totally gross me out.
Like Central Iowa is not known for its fish either.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't come to, you know what? If your idea is to come to Iowa for the seafood, don't.
There's this place in Cedar Rapids called Smuggler's Wharf, and it's like this fish-based place, but you know it all had to be frozen, right? I mean, isn't that the deal?
Yeah. I don't know. Unless they, like, fly it in and, like, parachute it down. I don't see how it
parachute
works.
Parachute fish.
Maybe there's a way.
Okay.
I have another one.
Okay.
The FDA is trying to decide whether and how to regulate poop. Poop. Fecal transplants getting a lot of attention these days as treatment for...
C. diff.
Yes. It's kind of the Wild West, though, at this point. So the concept is simple enough for anyone to do it. You take some poop from a healthy person, put it in an enema bottle, and give it to a sick person.
With some processing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about that. There is a popular YouTube video in which a mom sort of stands in her bathroom and goes through the process. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Thank God we don't have to see it.
It's pretty bad.
So I use a lot of stool. I feel like the more bacteria, the better. Fecal transplant is sort of viewed as the ultimate probiotic, so I figure I want to just put as much poop as I possibly can. So let's see, fill it up. Let's see, probably to about 175 mLs.
Kind of a lot.
At the end of the day, I only use, about 4.5 ounces. The slurry to do the fecal transplant enema, but I figure some gets left behind in the strainer. And then I just pour some saline. I more than cover it. You can always add more if it's too thick, but you can't really take the saline away once you do it. So you just kind of have to play with it. And you know, really actually just depend on how what the water content is in the stool. So and I just cover it up.
Well, that's enough of that.
So did you watch this video?
I did.
Just I did.
Fortunately, it's the video is shot from far away, relatively speaking. So the details aren't there. I want to know. Like, okay, let's not make too much light of this because this is yet another problem where C. diff not easily treated, there's a lot of antibiotic resistance involved. I think with C. diff. So people are again choosing sort of a DIY approach out of desperation. So these people are, you know, they're pretty desperate.
Yeah, but it shows that there's a willingness on the part of the public to try this new therapy.
Which and it's a disgusting therapy. I mean, let's face it, it's gross.
Yeah, sure, but it's effective.
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, the fact that, I mean, usually, you know, like think about a feminine hygiene product commercial, you know, where it's like the blue liquid and I would have appreciated it if she used some sort of, you know, substitute substance when I watched this video.
Yes,
perhaps
sure.
A, you know, some purple paint. I don't know. You know, just anything other than what it was. And also, you know, if you want your weird treatment, you know, quote unquote weird treatment to sort of reach the masses, you probably want to remove the word fecal from it. from its name.
I agree. The whole fecal transplant thing. You think they'd come up with a catchy phrase for it or something that or would they could market.
Indicate that you're trying to do the gut bacteria. You don't have to explain in that title fecal say that microbiome adjustment.
Or flora. Flora sound really nice.
This woman, I couldn't really hear it all. Yes, flora. It sounds like something you might go to the store to buy. Like, I'm going to buy some flora. And you couldn't hear her very well in the first part of the quote I played, but she called it the ultimate probiotic. So,
You're putting bacteria.
So the FDA, of course, needs to get their two cents in. And the truth is, most patients want their docs to be involved, but up until recently, doctors would have to file a lot of paperwork for treating patients with a new drug. And there's all sorts of clinical trial situations and things like that. Drugs equal paperwork, clinical trials, big money. Tissue donation, though, could be considered a tissue donation, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'd do that.
I would make sense.
Better. Still means lots of testing and lab work to make sure the donation isn't pathogenic.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, so the doctor looks at this donation and is like, oh, there's something in there that shouldn't be put in. Now he's got two patients because he can't just say this person's sick.
Or
he has to deal with the second patient.
He's now helping two people.
That's a good point, too. But and some also advocate for creating rules specific to bacterial implants. Anyway, January 2014, FDA has decided that fecal transplants should be regulated as a drug. But to keep them moving, at least until treatment was finally approved, the agency said it would exercise enforcement discretion. So basically, you can do it. We'll turn the other cheek kind of thing. Meaning healthcare providers could go on administering transplants for recurrent C. diff without filing paperwork for new drugs.
So that seems really weird. They wouldn't regulate that tighter.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're sort of giving into the fact that this is an effective treatment.
Right.
But they don't know what to do with it yet. They don't know how to enforce it yet. So they don't want to, hold things back. Popular Science reported in February of this year, the first fecal transplant bank opened in Massachusetts, a joint called Open Biome. So things are looking up for
Biome.
Good. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah. Open poop probably didn't focus well. No. Open feces.
But see,
not nearly as.
If you had to go to your local flora shop.
Oh,
flora shop. florist.
Flora.
Is C. diff only? I assume there's like a wide variety of applications of this far beyond.
The one that seems to get talked about most in the media. But yeah, if you go to YouTube and look up fecal transplant, you'll find a whole bunch of videos.
At your own risk.
Talking about the benefits for various diseases.
So I'm not sure how blood's classified, but why would this be classified differently than a blood product?
I think because it's gross. I honestly think that that's it. I think that it's unpalatable to most people. And so somebody's like, well, this is too gross to even think about. We're gonna regulate it. I don't know. That's probably not true.
The FDA group.
That's probably an ill-considered, one of my many ill-considered positions.
Not you, Dave.
So how does donation work for this then?
It's very simple. So you poop into a container and you are, it gets mixed with saline.
I figure now they have a donation bank. There's got to be some established procedure.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
the bank is interesting to me because
the nurse gives you a cup of coffee before you head into the room.
What I've generally heard is that they try and use family members because you have similar exposures.
Yeah. Sure.
So,
this video
bank is interesting.
This video is of a mom who has been treating her daughter who has recurrent C. diff.
The ultimate gift.
So. Indeed. Speaking of poop, Huffington Post suggests that you tune into Discovery Fit and Health tonight to watch Untold Stories of the ER.
Ooh.
You'll hear the riveting story of a mother who bought tapeworm eggs from Mexico to give to her daughter so that she would be ready for the pageant. Daughter and mother came to the ER with a swollen belly, which staff thought was pregnancy. Daughter got sick in the bathroom and sacrificed a bowl full of tapeworms to the porcelain god. So, that's something you could watch tonight. Do you remember when the Discovery Channel was all about science and learning?
Vaguely.
Once upon a time.
Yeah. You don't see that anymore.
Ice road truckers.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on the Short Code Podcast. The
Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see is a child. Your eyes